Thank you. Good afternoon. It's a very great pleasure to be here. I have lived all of my life either on the West Coast or in Japan, and most of my West Coast time has been in the rural areas and particularly in the mountains. Since 1970, I've lived on the 3,000-foot level of the northern Sierra Nevada on the west side, northeast of Sacramento, California, in the watershed of the Yuba River, on a homestead, a farmstead that does not yet have grid electricity, even, and is 3 miles by gravel road from the nearest paved road, which is one of the last paved roads in the county to get snowplowed. So in a mixed pine and pine oak conifer forest of that Sierra Nevadan type, mountains, and the tradition of painting landscapes which generally seem to include mountains, especially in East Asia. The 5th century AD Chinese painter Zhong Ping, of whom no paintings survive, but did leave a little text behind, and he wrote, "Mountains start in the material world, but soar into the realm of the spirit," which sounds kind of spiritual. Although, when you come right down to it, I recollect when I was a little kid growing up in the Pacific Northwest, in the countryside north of Seattle, on a small dairy farm, that the occasional vision, view of Mount Rainier rising on one of those rare clear days somehow touched the heart, did and always will. The otherworldliness, you might say, of that high floating mass of snow and glacier, far higher than anything you can ordinarily imagine, is what Zhong Ping must have been aiming at when he said, "soars into the realms of the spirit." It does archetypally, mythopoetically, suggest another world. And so I was touched by that early. And it was in the family tradition, my uncles were fishermen and loggers, to work in the woods. I had seasonal jobs for the Park Service and the Forest Service from early on, and worked on fire lookouts in my early 20s for the U.S. Forest Service, which gave me my first sense of how great the space up there was. That plus Snow Peak mountaineering, also something that people do up in the Pacific Northwest because of all the volcanoes. And I started doing that when I was 15 with a climbing club called the Mazamas out of Portland, Oregon. And then when I was 11 or 12, taking advantage of the Seattle Art Museum, my parents dropped me off there from time to time when they drove to town on business, I came across my first sight of, I think it was a hanging scroll of an East Asian landscape painting. That would have been around 1938 or 39 or a little later maybe. And I recall vividly that particular kind of painting, that scroll and maybe some others were up, grabbed my attention in a unique way. I had, of course, seen European landscape paintings in other galleries and in other rooms of the museum, which I didn't even notice, actually, because I thought they didn't do it right. But when I saw the East Asian hanging scrolls, something clicked in me, and I thought, whoever does that, not knowing exactly how to categorize the cultures or the traditions, whoever does that knows what they're doing. And that started me on a path toward becoming more and more a student of East Asian cultures, in particular China, and then a little later Japan. All of that led to me ultimately working on this long poem sequence called Mountains and Rivers Without End. As a mountain person and as a seasonal worker for the Forest Service and the Park Service in my earlier days, trail crew, firefighting, fire lookout, and mountaineer, and rock climber, and snow peak climber, whatever kind of a mountain it is, whether it's a creative exercise or a literal representation, I look to see where the trail would go. And I check out the cliffs and the rocks for possible routes. How would you climb that cliff? And that is a natural response of a West Coast climber. And it's an interesting way, but maybe an uncommon way, to look at paintings. So now I'm going to read a little bit from the essay I wrote, published in the back of Mountains and Rivers Without End, the book, on the making of this scroll, of this poem. An artist scholar, I would call myself, which is a term that you can use in Chinese culture, but we don't actually have an understanding of what that might mean in the Occident, I'm afraid. And as an artist considering poetry as one of the arts and equivalent in its own way to music, to graphic arts, sculpture, painting, and the psychology and the discipline, the time involved, and the inspiration that are part of any one of the arts is analogous in all of the arts. The making of Mountains and Rivers Without End. As a student at Reed College in the 40s, I had the good fortune to study with the brilliant polymath Lloyd Reynolds, who was, among many things, a remarkable calligrapher in the Renaissance italic mode. It was from Lloyd I learned to appreciate the pen, whether reed, turkey feather, or turkey quill, or carefully hand-ground alloy steel tip. One of Lloyd's students was Charles Leong, a Chinese-American veteran born and raised in Portland, Oregon, back from World War II and studying on the GI Bill. He was already an accomplished seal carver and a brush calligrapher of Chinese. With Charlie as my guide, I learned to hold the brush as well as the pen. And I had been introduced to the high snow peaks of the Pacific Northwest when I was 15 and had climbed a number of summits before I was 20. I was forever changed by that place of rock and sky. East Asian landscape painting seen at the Seattle Art Museum also presented such a space. While a student in college, I stumbled onto Ernest Fenollosa's Epochs of Chinese and Japanese Art, 2 volumes, at the Goodwill, which gave me further guidance into Asian art. And Fenollosa also led me to the translations from the Chinese that had been done by Ezra Pound. After a brief spell of graduate study in anthropological linguistics, I entered graduate school in East Asian languages at the University of California at Berkeley. And I signed up for a class in Sumi painting, East Asian brush painting, in the art department. The instructor was an intense, diminutive Japanese man named Chiura Obata. Obata had us grinding ink seriously and working with an array of brushes, which we learned by trying to match his fierce, swift strokes that made pine needles, bamboo stalks, and eucalyptus leaves appear as if by magic on the white pages. Obata was a naturalized citizen who had already put his time in an internment camp. I learned little else about him. And though I lacked talent, my practice with soot-black ink and brush tuned my eye for looking more closely at paintings. In museums and through books, I became aware of the energies of mist, whitewater, rock formations, and swirls, a chaotic universe where everything is in place, is so much a part of the East Asian painter's world. In one book, and it was Hugo Munsterberg's book on Chinese landscape painting, I came upon a reference to a hand scroll. That's the horizontal scrolls that unroll on a tabletop, a shojuan, called Mountains and Rivers Without End. The name and its planetary implications stuck in my mind. While I was a student at Berkeley, I worked seasonally in the mountains, the national parks, and the national forests. Seasons on Fire Lookouts, Crater Mountain, 1952, Sourdough Mountain, 1953, in what was then the Mount Baker National Forest, not very far south of the Canadian border. And that gave me the full opportunity to watch the change of mood that came over vast landscapes, light moving through the day, countless clouds, towering cumulus, black thunderstorms rolling in with jagged lightning strokes. Climbing to the summit of a mountain as a mountaineer, you rarely are able to stay more than 2 or 3 hours, and then you'd better go down before dark, certainly. So the fire lookout work gave me another dimension, which was to see what it looked like all day, every day, and every day was different, especially in the North Cascades. That prolonged stay gave me the first opportunity to learn to sit cross-legged as well in the practical and traditional postures of Buddhist meditation. Thoughts of that time, along with a half year spent working as a logger for a logging company in Eastern Oregon, took shape in a poem called Myths and Texts. This sequence was my first venture into the long poem and the challenge of interweaving physical life and inward realms. I kept studying Chinese and Japanese languages and practiced calligraphy with the brush while finishing writing Myths and Texts. My interest in Zen Buddhism led me to lectures given by Alan Watts at the American Academy of Asian Studies in San Francisco. This is when I'm back in Berkeley in graduate school again. We became friends on the basis of our shared interest in Renaissance Italic calligraphy, more than in Buddhism even. And then a Japanese painter named Saburo Hasegawa came to be in residence at the Academy of Asian Studies, a man I never saw wearing Western clothes. He always wore men's kimono and men's hakama. And yet he was a very wild and, you might say, contemporary painter. Hasegawa at some one point heard that I had never tasted ceremonial powdered green tea, matcha, and he invited me to his apartment. I still remember the date. It was April 8th, 1956, the Buddha's birthday, April 8th. He frothed up the tea with a bamboo whisk. We chatted, talked at length about Japanese paintings, and in particular, the work of the Japanese painter Sesshu, who also did hand scrolls. Sesshu was a Zen monk, too. I asked Hasegawa, do you suppose it would be possible to represent the endless mountains and streams conception of Chinese paintings in poetry? He said, sure, why not? Do it. And so that got me started on another long poem that would be called Mountains and Rivers Without End. Only a month later, I was on board a Japanese passenger freighter traveling westward toward the east to do some study in Kyoto, Japan. I lived in a Rinzai Zen temple compound called Shokokuji and immediately started to explore the local forests and hills. I found the trails. I found the shrines. I paid my respects to the local kami, the local nature spirits. In my small spare time, I read geology and geomorphology. And I came to see the yogic implications of mountains and rivers as the play between the tough spirit of willed self-discipline and the generous and loving spirit of concern for all beings, a dyad presented in Buddhist iconography as the wisdom sword-wielding Manjushri, embodying transcendent insight, and his partner, Tara, the embodiment of compassion, holding a lotus or a vase. And I could imagine this dyad as paralleled in the dynamics of mountain uplift, subduction, erosion, and the planetary water cycle. Most of the 60s, I lived in Japan. But I took a break one time to work 9 months on a tanker that went between the Persian Gulf and mid-Pacific oil ports, and then a visit back to the West Coast in 1964 got me into the High Sierra, a refreshing return to the realm of rock and ice. And I showed Donald Allen, an editor and publisher in San Francisco, what I had done so far on Mountains and Rivers Without End. It was only 6 longish poems, and he brought out a small book of the 6 sections under that title. Though my main reason for living in Kyoto was to do Zen Buddhist practice, I was also fortunate enough to make contact with the Yamabushi, the mountain Buddhist group, and I was given a chance to see how walking a landscape can be both a ritual and a meditation. I did the 5-day pilgrimage on the Omine Ridge and established a tentative relationship with the archaic Buddhist mountain deity, Fudo, Fudo Myo, or known in Sanskrit as Achala. This ancient exercise has one visualizing the hike from peak to valley floor as an interlinking of the womb realm and the diamond realm, mandalas of Vajrayana Buddhism. I was studying under the Roshi of Daitokuji, Oda Sesso, and I had moved into a little place that was only 10 minutes from the monastery. I got to see rare Japanese and Chinese scrolls in the richly endowed Buddhist temples of Kyoto, especially those that belong within Daitokuji. Poems for the Mountains and Rivers Without End sequence kept showing up at the rate about once a year. I was writing other poems at the same time, but they were different, more lyrical, and quite a bit shorter. Then I came back to the United States on another visit. And while giving poetry readings and talks around the country, through the 70s and 80s, whenever I was here, I was able to visit most of the major collections of Chinese paintings in the United States. The curators at the Freer generously let me have 2 private viewings of Lu Yuan's Qing scroll called Mountains and Rivers Without End, the very one that first came to my attention in Hugo Munsterberg's book. My first visit to the Freer actually was in the mid-60s, which is half my lifetime ago. There was no Sackler then. I met Joseph Cahill then. He was the curator for that collection then. And they gave me a viewing of the scroll down in the basement, the Mountains and Rivers Without End scroll, when it was still attributed to a painter named Xu Bun from the Yuan Dynasty. I took extensive notes on it for over 2.5 hours. Somebody always stood there watching me. And I was instructed from the beginning No fountain pen, no ballpoint pen. All notes to be taken only with a pencil because something might drip. Well, I understand. That's very smart. The next time I looked at the Lu Yuan scroll in the same way, the same generous private viewing in the basement, it was now attributed to Lu Yuan of the Qing Dynasty. And so knowledge goes on, if that's what it is. And I appreciated in the collection of the Freer from the mid-60s on, to just mention a few, the rare Guoxi paintings, one Cheng Ming's small hand scroll illustrating the Red Cliff Fu poem by Su Shi, with the little boat going down the rapids alongside the Great Red Cliff. Su Shi, wonderful, one of the top Chinese poets and also a great administrator, the governor of all South China, is half drunk in a boat with some girls singing. It's a wonderful poem, too. So that's in the Freer collection. And Wang Hu's big long scroll called Dwelling in the Fuchun Mountains, a horizontal scroll, with a lot of watercourses in it, and what you would consider normal and available mountains. It would be hard to believe that the Yellow Mountains actually existed in the real world if it weren't for the fact that they do. I don't think there is any other mountain range in the world that is quite as severe as that. And I still have to look up the geology and figure out how it came about. I also roamed the Nelson Gallery in Kansas City, the Honolulu Academy of Art, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, went to Europe to see the British Museum and the Stockholm National Museum, always made good use of the Asian Art Museum of San Francisco. And finally, I got to the Palace Museum in Beijing and the huge Palace Museum in Taipei, where I was deeply moved to see calligraphy from the hand of Su Shi himself, that Su Deng Po. Gazing at these many paintings was each time a mysterious and enlarging experience. And I read the books and the essays that I could by James Cahill, Wen Feng, Sherman Lee, and others. It was Sherman Lee's study, done together with Wen Feng, of the Shan Qi Wu Jin Sung Dynasty hand scroll that's at Cleveland. His study of that is what led me to make use of it for the opening poem in this book, and I'm going to be reading that to you in a few minutes. But there's a couple other more points here that have to be completed. In the late 70s, my thinking was invigorated by translations from the Zen 12th century Zen Buddhist philosopher and priest Dogen, or Dayuan in Chinese. Dogen's Treasury of the True Law was just then beginning to come out in English translation. He has a piece in there called the San Sui Kyo, or that would be in Chinese the Shan Shui Jing, the Sutra of Mountains and Waters. It is a pearl of a text, and it also made me think more about rivers. What with mountaineering and seasonal labor, I had plenty of firsthand experience with mountains, but now I studied waters, and I spun and dashed down many rapids with rowdy and convivial company. River runners are such rowdy people. I don't know why. And then at some point, about then, I became aware of the powerful, light-filled watercolor paintings and color woodblocks, woodblock prints, of California mountain landscapes that had been done by my old Berkeley teacher, Chiura Obata. It turned out that he had explored and sketched and done artwork out of the Sierra High Country starting in the 1920s. And there is a book of those representing, publishing some of those wonderful color prints that Obata-san did before World War II. It's now published. It's Obata's Yosemite is the title of it. It's published by the Yosemite Association, still in print. His reputation has steadily grown in the last 25 years. Had a big show at the De Young. It was the last show at the De Young Museum in Golden Gate Park before they closed it down for rebuilding and moved all of the Asian collection downtown to the Civic Center, where it became the Asian Art Museum, and that's what it is now. So Obata is finally getting some recognition. He first came to the United States when he was a young man, I think about 1914, 1915. After having done full-scale art studies at Tokyo University for 6 years. During the last 20 years of working on this poem, or these poems, were enlarged by other experiences, walking trips in major urban centers, particularly Manhattan, working alongside my brilliant and cranky neighbors in the Sierra foothills, laboring hands-on at forest and ecosystem management chores, studying landscape and forest ecology. That's not landscape, that's landscape ecology and forest ecology. There is a field now, fascinating, landscape ecology. And the lessons of our local watershed, getting down to the details of the tiniest rivulets and the hillocks. And then the joys and teachings that come with family life, my wife, Carol, and my sons and daughters. By the 1990s, I was teaching part-time at UC Davis, 108 miles away down in the Sacramento Valley. And I was able then also to turn my full attention to finishing Mountains and Rivers Without End. In April 1996, the 40th anniversary of my 1956 tea ceremony with Saburo Hasegawa. A few of us old mountain Buddhist poetry green avant-garde types got together again in San Francisco at a Japanese restaurant to remember old comrades, to declare this project ended, and to drink a cup to William Butler Yeats's phrase, the supreme theme of art and song. The Tang poet, Bai Jue, said, I have long had the desire that my actions in this world and any problems caused by my crazy words and extravagant language will in times to come be transformed into a clarification of the Dharma and be but another way to spread the Buddhist teachings. May it be so. Now, a few selections from Mountains and Rivers Without End, opening with some quotations. The notion of emptiness engenders compassion. That was Milarepa. And this is Dogen. An old-time Buddha said, a painted rice cake does not satisfy hunger. Dogen's comment on that was, there are very few who have ever seen this little painting of a rice cake, and none of them thoroughly understand it. The paints for painting rice cakes are the same as those used for painting mountains and waters. If you say that the painting isn't real, then the material phenomenal world is not real. The Dharma is not real. Unsurpassed enlightenment is a painting. The entire phenomenal universe and the empty sky are nothing but paintings. Since this is so, there is no remedy for satisfying hunger other than a painted rice cake. Without painted hunger, you can never become a true person. That's Dogen. Endless Streams and Mountains, Qishan Wujin. This is the scroll at the Cleveland. Changing the mind, clearing the mind, and sliding into that created space, a web of waters streaming over rocks, air misty but not raining, seeing this land from a boat on a lake or a broad, slow river, coasting by. The path comes down along a lowland stream, slips behind boulders and leafy hardwoods, reappears in a pine grove. No farms, just tidy cottages and shelters, gateways, rest stops, roofed but unwalled workspace. It's a warm, damp climate. A trail of climbing stair steps forks upstream. Big ranges lurk behind those rugged little outcrops, those spits of low ground with rocky uplift, layered pinnacles aslant, flurries of brushy cliffs receding, far back and high above, vague peaks. A man hunched over, sitting on a log. Another stands above him, lifts a staff. A third, with a roll of mats, or maybe a lute, looks on. A bit offshore, two people in a boat. The trail goes far inland, somewhere back around a bay, lost in distant foothill slopes, and comes back again at a village on the beach and somebody's fishing. A rider and a walker cross a bridge above a frothy, braided torrent that descends from a flurry of roofs like flowers, temples tucked between cliffs. A side trail goes there, a jumble of cliffs above, ridge tops edged with bushes, valley fog below, a hazy horizon. A man with a shoulder load leans into the grade, another horse and hiker. The trail goes up a long cascading stream bed, no bridge in sight, comes back through Chinquapin or Liquidambar. Trail ends at the edge of an inlet, below a heavy set of dark rock hills, two moored boats with basket roofing. A boatman lost in thought stands in the bow. Hills beyond rivers, willows in a swamp, a gentle valley reaching far inland. The waiting boat, the watching boat, has floated off the page. At the end of the hand scroll, it continues on with seals and poems and tells a further tale. These are the colophons. These are the poems and the seals that complete an East Asian painting. Very important. Quote, Wang Wenwei saw this at the mayor's house in Hutong town in the year 1205. Wrote at the end of it, the fashioner of things has no original intentions. Mountains and rivers are spirit condensed. Who has come up with these miraculous forests and springs, pale ink on fine white silk? Later that same month, someone named Li Hui added, quote, most people can get along with the noise of dogs and chickens. Everybody cheerful in these peaceful times. But I, why are my tastes so odd? I love the company of streams and boulders. Tian Xie of Weilo, no date, next wrote, the water holds up the mountains. The mountains go down in the water. In 1332, Zhe Shun adds, this is truly a painting worth careful keeping, and it has poem colophons from the Sung and the Qin dynasties. That it survived dangers of fire and war makes it even rarer. And in the mid-17th century, one Wang To had a look at it, saying, "My brother's relative by marriage, one Sun, is learned and has good taste. He writes good prose and poetry. My brother brought over this painting of his to show me." The great Qing dynasty collector Liang Qingbiao owned it, but didn't write on it or cover it with any seals. From him, it went into the imperial collection down to the early 20th century. Chang Dajian sold it in 1949. Now it's at the Cleveland Art Museum, which sits on a rise that looks out toward the waters of Lake Erie. Step back and gaze again at the land. It rises and subsides. Ravines and cliffs like waves of blowing leaves. Stamp the foot, walk with it, clap, turn. The creeks come in, strained through boulders, mountains walking on the waters, water ripples every hill. I walk out of the museum, low gray clouds over the lake, chill March breeze. Old ghost ranges, sunken rivers, come again. Stand by the wall and tell their tale. Walk the path, sit the reins, grind the ink, wet the brush, unroll the broad white space, lead out and tip the moist black line. Walking on walking, underfoot earth turns. Streams and mountains never stay the same. So that's the opening poem to Mountains and Rivers Without End. It goes to this next poem, which is a little invocation to the ancients, to our ancestors, to all of our ancestors. It's called Old Bones. Out there, walking around, looking out for food, a rootstock, a bird call, a seed that you could crack, plucking, digging, snaring, snagging, barely getting by. No food out there on dusty slopes of scree. Carry some, look for some, go for a hungry dream. Deer bone, dal sheep, bones, hunger, home. Out there somewhere, a shrine for the old ones, the dust of the old bones, old songs and tales. What we ate, who ate what, how we all prevailed. The Falls. This is selected out of a larger poem called The Flowing. This is a poem for Yosemite Falls in the Yosemite Valley. If you've never been to Yosemite Valley, you'll be shocked because it's always better than you thought it would be. Grand Canyon is like that, and so is the Taj Mahal. Those are three very positive surprises I've had in my life where I thought, oh, maybe it'll be disappointing. No way. The cover of the book, the paperback book here, that's a print by Chira Obata from his 1920s sketches and work in the Yosemite country. And that is Yosemite Falls coming over the rocks there. Over stone lip, the creek leaps out as one, divides in spray and streamers, Let's it all go. Above, back there, the snowfields, rocked between granite ribs, turn spongy in the summer sun. Water slips out under, mucky, shallow flows, enmeshed with roots of flower and moss and heather, seeps through swampy meadows, gathers to shimmer sandy, shiny flats, then soars off ledges. Crash and thunder on the boulders at the base. Painless, playing, droplets regather. Seek the lowest and keep going down in gravelly beds. There is no use. The water cycle tumbles round. Sierra Nevada could lift the heart so high. Fault block uplift, thrust of westward slipping crust, one way to raise and swing the clouds around. Thus pine trees leapfrog up on sunlight, trapped in cells of leaf. Nutrient minerals called together like a magic song to lead a cedar log along that hopes to get to sea and last and be a great canoe. A soft breath worldwide of night and day, rising, falling. The great mind passes by its own fine-honed thoughts, going each way. Rainbow hanging steady, only slightly wavering with the swing of the whole spill. Between the rising and the falling, stands still. I stand drenched in crashing spray and mist and pray. Raven's Beak River at the end. Raven's Beak is the translation into English from the Athabascan word Tatshinshin or Tatshinshini. So this is the Tatshinshini River that rises in eastern British Columbia and crosses on into southeast Alaska and finally goes out into the Gulf of Alaska at a place that is quite misnamed, called Dry Bay, where it rains continuously. This was part of my study of rivers. At the Doab of the Tatshinshini River and the Alsek Lake, a long spit of gravel, one clear day, after days on the river in the rain, the glowing sandy slopes of Castalea blooms, little fox tracks in the moose print swales, and giant scoops of dirt took out by bears around the lupin roots in early light, a rim of snowy mountains and the ice fields slanting back for miles, I find my way to the boulders on the gravel in the flowers at the end of the glacier. Two ravens sitting on a boulder, carried by the glacier, left on the ground, resting in the flowers at the end of the ice age. Show me the way to a place to sit in a hollow on a boulder, looking east, looking south, ear in the river running just behind me, nose in the grasses, vetch roots scooped out by the bears in the gravels, looking up the ice slopes, ice plains, rock fall, brush line, dirt sweeps, on the ancient river, blue queen floating in ice lake, ice throne, end of a glacier. Looking north, up the dancing river, where it turns into a glacier. Under stair steps of ice falls, green streaks of alder climb the mountain knuckles, interlaced with snowfields, foamy water falling, salmon weaving river, bear flower, blue sky singer. As the raven leaves her boulder, flying over flowers, raven sitting high spot, eyes on the snow peaks, nose of morning, raindrops in the sunshine, skin of sunlight, skin of chilly gravel, mind in the mountains, mind of tumbling waters, mind running rivers, mind of sifting flowers in the gravels at the end of an ice age. We are the bears. We are the ravens. We are the salmon in the gravel at the end of an ice age, growing on the gravels at the end of a glacier, flying off alone, flying off alone, flying off alone, off alone. That has become more true than I thought it would when I wrote it. Because, you know, with climate change and the apparent global warming, it really does mark the end of the ice age, probably. Earth Verse, Central Australian Desert, wide enough to keep you looking, open enough to keep you moving, dry enough to keep you honest, prickly enough to make you tough, green enough to go on living, old enough to give you dreams. Earth Verse. And the final poem in this whole sequence is called Finding the Space in the Heart. Some of you will recognize this as one of the largest playas in the world in northern Nevada. A playa is a dry lake bed, perfectly flat, miles wide, miles long, such as is the Bonneville Salt Flats. That is the largest playa in the world. And all of these dry lake beds that you find in the Great Basin are memories of Lake Lahontan, an inland sea that went almost from the Rockies to the Cascades at various times, a few thousand years back, a few millennia back. Finding the space in the heart. I first saw it in the 60s, driving a Volkswagen camper with a fierce gay poet and a lovely but dangerous girl with a husky voice. We came down from Canada, on the dry east side of the ranges, Grand Coulee, Blue Mountains, the Lava Flow Caves, the Alvord Desert, Pronghorn Ranges, and the glittering obsidian-paved dirt track toward Via. Seldom seen roads, late September and thick frost at dawn. Then follow a canyon and suddenly open to silvery flats that curved over the edge. The awareness of emptiness brings forth a heart of compassion. We followed the rim of the playa to a bar where the roads end, and then over a pass into Pyramid Lake from the Smoke Creek side, by the ranches of wizards who follow the teepee path. The next day we reached San Francisco, in a time when it seemed the world might head a new way. And again, in the 70s, back from Montana, we recklessly pulled off the highway, took a dirt track onto the flats, got stuck, scared the kids, slept the night, and the next day sucked free and went on. 15 years passed. In the 80s, with my lover I went where the roads end, walked the hills for a day, looked out where it all drops away, and discovered a path of carved stone inscriptions tucked into the sagebrush. Stomp out greed. And the best things in life are not things. Words placed by an old desert sage. Faint shorelines seen high on the slopes. Long gone Lake Lahontan. Cutthroat trout spirit in silt. Columbian mammoth bones, 400 feet up on the wave-etched beach ledge, curly-horned desert sheep outlines pecked into the rock, and turned the truck onto the playa, heading for no knot, bone-gray dust boiling and billowing, mile after mile, trackless and featureless, let the car coast to a halt on the crazed, cracked, flat, hard face where winter snow spirals and summer sun bakes like a kiln, off nowhere to be or not be. All equal, far reaches, no bounds, sound swallowed away, no waters, no mountains, no bush, no grass, because no grass, no shade but your shadow. No flatness, because no not flatness. No loss, no gain, so nothing in the way. The ground is the sky is the ground. No place between, just wind-whipped breeze, tent-mouth leeward, time being here. We meet heart to heart, leg hard twined to leg, with a kiss that goes to the bone. Dawn sun comes straight in the eye, the tooth of a far peak called King Lear. Now in the 90s desert night, old friends, old trucks drawn round, great arcs of kids on bikes out there in darkness, no lights, just planet Venus glinting by the calyx crescent moon, and tasting grasshoppers roasted in a pan. They all somehow swarm down here. Sons and daughters in the circle, eating grasshoppers, grimacing, singing sutras for the insects in the wilderness. The wideness, the foolish, loving spaces full of heart. Walking on walking. Underfoot, earth turns. Streams and mountains never stay the same. The space goes on. But the wet black brush, tip drawn to a point, lifts away. Thank you.